So we're going to get started here. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to CSIS. My name is Carl Meacham. I'm the director here of the Americas Program. I'm glad you could join us. Today's event, El Salvador's 2014 presidential election, What to Expect, is a really interesting opportunity for us to go over what's happening in El Salvador with one of our senior associates, Doug Farah, who his reputation precedes him. I'll go into little detail about who he is, but it's in the sheets that we've passed around a more complete bio. More than 4 million Salvadorans will be heading to the polls on February 2nd to take part in the first round of presidential elections. The primary candidates for this election are current Vice President Salvador Sanchez Serén of the incumbent FMLN, San Salvador Mayor Norman Quijano of the Alianza Republicana Nacionalista, ARENA, former President Antonio Saca of UNIDAD, the coalition between Gran Alianza por la Unidad Nacional, and the Partido Demócrata Cristiano, Partido de la Esperanza. While recent polls vary with their predictions for February 2nd, most put Sanchez Serén in a solid lead, with Quijano trailing closely and Saca lagging far behind. According to the Universidad Centroamericana's most recent survey, Sanchez Serén is leading with 46.8% of support, with Quijano and Saca at 32.8% and 14.7% respectively. El Salvador's runoff electoral system requires that a candidate win with at least 51% of the vote to pull off a first-round victory. Because it seems unlikely that any of the candidates will garner that much support by February 2nd, we can expect a runoff election between Sanchez Serén and Quijano, slated for March 9. This election is an important one for El Salvador, as the candidates will seek to address the country's most pressing problems: persistent inequality, endemic insecurity, and rampant gang violence and drug trafficking, among others. With an anemic annual GDP growth rate of less than 2%, El Salvador's income distribution is highly uneven. The top fifth of society holds more than half of the country's wealth, while the lowest fifth holds less than 5%. And problems with insecurity are no smaller. The country is frequently listed among the most dangerous in the world, with a per capita murder rate of 43.3 per 100,000 people and growing. And the murder rate in El Salvador, or in San Salvador, the country's capital, is even higher. These problems must also be taken in the context of the country's ongoing gang problem, largely a conflict between the Mara Salvatrucha MS-13 and the Barrio 18, or 18th Street gang, and its perennial problem with drug trafficking. These problems are not unique to El Salvador, nor are their implications. It's important that we look at the elections then in a regional context as well. And, when we deal with El Salvador, and El Salvador is a small country, a little over 6 million people. It's not Brazil, it's not Mexico. And I think it's sometimes we forget, or I think we need to articulate why it's relevant, why it's important. Besides having you here today, Doug, I'm just going to mention a couple of points. With approximately 1.1 million Salvadoran immigrants currently residing in the United States, about one in five Salvadorans in the world live in the U.S. As inequality and insecurity continue to plague the country's social fabric, undocumented immigrants will come to flow into the United States, and illegal immigration is, as we all know, very sensitive here in Washington. And the war on drugs, deeply felt in El Salvador, could not be more relevant to the rest of the hemisphere. Central America and the Caribbean are increasingly seen as the new fronts in this conflict. Doug is an expert on these issues, and the role of U.S. policy in particular will certainly change moving forward. So developments in Salvadoran politics, particularly in its drug policy, carry implications for security throughout the region. So there's a lot at stake here that isn't just related to what's happening in Salvador or in Central America. These are issues that have to do with U.S. interests in the region as well, and they have pretty direct consequences for U.S. foreign policy in Central America. So to discuss the context of the upcoming election and the candidates themselves, I'm pleased to introduce our guest, Doug Farah, president of IBI Consultants and senior associate at the CSIS Americas program. Doug has had over 30 years of experience working in El Salvador and will be visiting the country in the run-up to the election. He is an expert on a number of issues key to these elections, including the transnational crime organizations, insurgencies, ungoverned spaces, illicit money flows, and resource exploitation in Latin America. I won't go on and on and on because we could with Doug, but you all know he's testified in front of Congress as well, and I think folks that I respect a lot in this town rely on him for advice and counsel. The usual procedures apply for today's event. When we go into the Q&A period of today's session, please identify yourself. If you want to give your opinion, and we have people like Roger Noriega here, who's the former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere, we welcome your expertise and your opinion. But please, let's try to get everybody's opinion or views involved. So without further ado, Doug, if you'd like to come to the podium or sit down. It's up to you. Great. Excellent.
Well, thank you, Carl, for that generous introduction. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for coming out on such a grim day. If you follow my anything I've written on Central America, you know I'm not an optimist. I tend to be one of the more pessimistic side of developments in the region. And as Carl said, I think you have to look at what's happening in El Salvador and in the context, particularly of the Northern Triangle of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, and then in the larger context of Central America. And I think in that context, you see an entire region now in which I have described in an article that was published in Prism magazine at National Defense University, is an area that has now gone from where I think they had weak and sort of but functional democratic institutions to a region where now basically everything is a transactional proposition, where everything is bought and sold, from justice to drugs to the movement of people across the governments and in the criminal structures in which each of the governments is deeply involved. I find that deeply disturbing. I find that Central America, I would say, we talk often about failed countries. I don't think this is a failed region. I think it's just a region that is turning increasingly into a series of functioning criminal enterprises rather than governments that are operating on behalf of the citizens and on behalf of the democratic process. So with that lovely introduction, you'll see how optimistic I am. I was struck because I've been covering El Salvador since 1985 in the middle of the wars. And lived there for 10 years, and they've been going back and forth ever since. At the deep change in the last couple of years, I would say, particularly from the enormous optimism that came out of the peace processes, and I think if you lived and covered those wars across the region, but particularly the war in El Salvador, there was huge potential for change. And I think that the FMLN had reached a point of negotiating into a settlement, and I think, as with Arena and President Cristiani, you had people enormously smart, enormously good of goodwill, who were moving toward an entirely new country. I think what you see now is that hope is entirely dissipated and replaced almost entirely with deep cynicism and deep pessimism about the country's future. So this election, I think, is coming on the heels of two really troublesome governments that El Salvador has had. If you look at the government, the last government of Arena, which was Tony Saca, he was expelled from his own party for having allegedly stolen the neighborhood of $460 million. That's an enormous amount of money, especially without the U.S. aid coming in. And the level of corruption which he brought to that process was unprecedented at the time, and Arena was disturbed enough by the process to expel him from the party, and he's now formed Ghana, which is the sort of swing vote in the process. And the FMLN had remained in opposition until they chose an unusual strategy that turned out to be successful, which was running Mauricio Funes, a former newscaster, as their president, a person who had not participated in the conflict, who was not a member of the FMLN, and had basically was untrusted by the structures of the FMLN into the government. And he was never, and I think this is crucial to understanding what's happening in El Salvador now, he was never an FMLN person. And I think that I don't know what he would tell you. Most of his people would tell you that he came in, and his natural ally as he moved forward was the Saka government. He brought in Saka's people. He brought in a lot of the worst elements, I would say, of the multiple different parties into his cabinet, and thus you see the decision of the Frente this time to go with a traditional historic figure in Salvador Sanchez Serén, because they lost control of the process of government, and in many ways, except for in the Legislative Assembly, have been excluded from the decision-making process in a very deliberate fashion by Funes. And the other thing that's striking heading into the elections is the enormously deteriorated relationship with the United States. I think that the Funes government, I think, did something that was really difficult to do, which was take a government that the United States and the Obama administration really wanted to work with. Obama visited there. The Millennium funds were given. The first tranche, the Millennium One funds were given. All of these indications, in part because Funes, in the initial days, was doing very much what the United States was asking him to do, which was not join ALBA, not join the Venezuelan rush. His wife being Brazilian, he kept saying initially that his model was Brazil, not Venezuela. And the United States was very open to this, and he had a very good relationship. I think because of his own personality, in which he has gone on television publicly to insult our ambassador there, has publicly insulted Senator Leahy, who was one of his great defenders in the U.S. Congress, insulted virtually everyone, both publicly and privately, as well as certain policy decisions he's making, and I think in the growing concerns about the deep corruption inside the Funes administration, have left that relationship pretty much in tatters. It's very difficult for the United States right now because there's not a good interlocutor. I had this sad experience of having dinner with a person that I admire greatly in El Salvador, who's been involved in the electoral process is going back to the 1970s, an old Christian Democrat who's now out of out of politics and things, but keeps obviously quite active. And I said, "So, you know, how do you view things?" Very optimistic. He said, "Douglas, I'll tell you the truth." He said, "I feel like a man in the forest looking at three trees trying to decide which one I'm going to hang myself from." And I think that is, in some ways, the most tragic thing coming out of the current process is that there are no good options. I think if you look at the FMLN, as Carl said, I think all the polls show that the FMLN is surging. There's very, very little question about that. They're up. I still have a very hard time believing that they could come close to 50% in the first round, but the polls, I think the 46 is the maximum. Most of them show them in the high 30s, but with an increasing distance with Quijano. And if you look at the campaign there, I've been going in and out every month, a month for the last while, and the truth is the FMLN has run a really good campaign, a really good ad campaign, and the Arena campaign has been abysmal. As far as the visuals, as far as the what they put on TV, what their ads are like, and so I think that what the Frente has been very careful to do is not remind anyone who Sanchez Serén really is. There's no talk about him being one of the five FMLN commanders. There's no talk about his group's failure to disarm following the 1991 peace agreements. There's no talk about how he ran if you recall, there was a big arsenal of clandestine weapons and a cache of thousands of documents, including many false documents, that exploded in 1992 in Managua, Nicaragua, and it was an FMLN, an FPL hideaway that Sanchez Serén's group had never turned over in the peace process, thousands of weapons. But that was 1992, and people, there's no recollection of that. And as Arena has tried to attack on that front, the Frente has not counterattacked at all. They've not said anything about anything, which has really, really been a really good strategy. I think that Saka is extremely problematic because of his past, as I've said before, and it's not a candidate that the United States would look to support, especially toward the end of his time when he brought in his cousin, who's also very close to the Funes government, who's been involved in multiple transnational criminal activities. I think that's a serious problem. And then you have Arena, which is much diminished. Arena, which governed from time Freddy Cristiani, 1988 forward until Funes, they seem to have abandoned their candidate completely. There's no money going into the Quijano campaign. I don't know if it's because people have decided he can't win and they're withdrawing, or if he's just not viewed as a candidate that the old guard Arenados would like. It's hard to say. If I spent some time with Quijano this time, I spent a lot of time with the FMLN leadership this time, and it's hard for me to decipher what happened, and it seems, talking to Mr. Quijano, that it's hard for him as well to decipher internally why he's been abandoned, or seems to have been abandoned by the party structure largely. And I think, looking, you know, historically, Arena's been problematic as well. You have a government that ran the country for a significant period of time in which none of the indices of violence, poverty, or anything were improved. And it's not like they had one turn and they were out. They ran from Cristiani to, and they had Paco Flores, and then they had Saca, they had somebody in between, Calderon Sol. And then, so they've had four or five administrations, and their track record in terms of bringing prosperity and change to the country is not very remarkable, and I think that explains entirely how the FMLN won, although historically their vote was always never went past 30% in the last election. With the new face, they went forward, and then Sanchez Serén is the historico, the historic figure going forward, is managing to greatly outpace the Arena folks going forward. I think some of the other things that, and so you have, I think, Arena really struggling. It's not clear what the correlation of forces will end up like in the assembly. One assumes that that's where Saca and Gana will make the most of their power. They will be a power in the National Assembly. If it goes to a second round, as most people still expect it to, then the vote of the movement of Saca and Gana and the remnants of the Christian Democratic Party and the others who have affiliated with Gana will be crucial. The question is, with Saca coming out of Arena and his bases being largely the conservative Arena base, if he goes with the FMLN, as he gives every indication of going, will anyone follow him? I think that's sort of where the question mark remains in that. If the FMLN gets over 42-43%, I think you can pretty much, the second round will be meaningless because they're going to win. If they stay below 40%, then you'll have a lot of competition for the vote of the bases of the Ghana party. What are the big issues? I think there are the gang issue, as Carl mentioned, I think is becoming increasingly problematic. And has gotten to the point where people are beginning to almost panic. I think if you look at the so-called truce that the government supported and negotiated with the help of the Organization of American States, I think it's pretty clear now, given the clandestine cemeteries that are being dug up and the number of bodies that are being found, that the truce was never much of a truce. It was a political agreement that has allowed the gangs to gain territorial control that they never had before. It has allowed the gangs to gain access to drug trafficking structures they never had before. It's allowed them privileges and to control the prisons entirely in which they're in. And the homicide rate, which was the only sort of justification for this happening, in the initial days it seemed to drop by about 50%. The official figures now have it back up to 80% of what it was, and if you look at the clandestine cemeteries that they're now finding across different parts of the country, where they're finding more than 100 bodies at a time, I think that those figures themselves will certainly, those are not counted in the homicide statistics yet. I think that the sharp drop in homicides will virtually disappear. And if you look at what Medicina Legal does, the people who go out and pull the bodies out of the graves, they're reporting that the number of people that are disappeared is more than would surpass the homicide rate at the highest point of El Salvador. And most of those disappeared, many of those disappeared are now being found in the clandestine cemeteries. There's nothing more sad, I think, having spent as much time watching, going collecting and watching people go recognize their relatives killed by the death squads in the 1980s, to watching the same type of people flowing into Medicina Legal, looking for disappeared people, putting pictures of their children on the wall, hoping that someone will recognize them. this far after the conflict returning to that, and what are they finding when they're digging up the graves? Systematic, ritualistic decapitation and cutting off the arms, legs, genitals, heads of everybody in every one of the graves they're pulling out now. It's been shocking to me that even though the head of Medicina Legal has gone out, the police have gone out, they're digging up the bodies, is barely touched in the Salvadoran press, and it certainly has not become a theme of this. And what's fascinating to me is all the bodies they're digging out right now are in clandestine cemeteries controlled by the Calle 18 gang. All of them that they've dug out were killed during the so-called truce. They're between 8 months to 2 weeks old. The truce is almost 2 years old. They've dug up two of multiple cemeteries. We knew the cemeteries existed starting 2 or 3 years ago because my sources in the gangs were telling me, one, that they existed, and two, a person who I work with closely there had been asked by his former FMLN combatant, had been asked by families of a kid who had disappeared to go find him, see what had happened. He finally did, and the gang said, yeah, well, you know, tell the family not to worry. And they said, well, what does that mean? Because gangs always give the bodies back as part of the ritual. And they said, well, it means he's dead. And he said, can they have the bodies back? They said, oh, man, we'd have to dig up the entire clandestine cemetery to find him. And, you know, we're not going to do that. That was more than 2 years ago. And this process has been creeping forward. So I think the gang issue, they've gone to massive extortion. One of their strategies has been to stop extorting people in their own neighborhoods, the pupuserias, the gaseosa sellers, although in the graves they're finding there are pupuseria and gaseosa vendors and evangelical pastors, all kinds of people put in the graves. And they're going after the bigger businesses now. They're extorting at a much higher level for a lot more money. There's clear linkages now between certain cliques of particularly MS-13 and the major transport networks of cocaine. I'm careful to say it's not the MS-13. There's as many relationships with transnational organized crime among the MS-13 in Calle 18 as there are cliques. Each clique has 15, 20, 25 people in their neighborhood. They're grouped in programas, which are the bigger structures of multiple cliques. There are programas deeply involved. It entirely depends on the territorial control those gangs exercise over areas that narco-traffickers want to use. If you're going through northern Metapan, which is the main way into Guatemala from the stuff that flows in from Honduras, you control really good real estate. These guys have to deal with you, and they do. And those are the cliques you see becoming much more incorporated. If you're out in the middle of nowhere in Chalatenango or La Union, and they don't need to look for you, then your clique will have no relationship because they don't need you, and they're not going to come look for you just because you're nice guys, because you're not nice guys. And you see the deterioration, you know, the growth of the gangs and the government at every step ceding to their demands, and so you now have the gangs as a real political power. And if you talk with the folks there in the gangs, they'll tell you it's not that they're forming a political party or have their own ideology. They are selling their votes to the highest bidder, and they'll say, look, we can guarantee that our neighborhood will vote for the people we tell them to, not only our families but everyone in the neighborhood, because we are the real force in that neighborhood. And as far as who they're supporting, it's almost entirely the FMLN at this point. I think one of the things that Quijano has said for Arena is that there will be a return to the mano dura, the more repressive strategies that also didn't work in the 1980s, and the gangs hate Tony Saca with a passion. The possibility of Ghana negotiating with them is essentially zero going in, because he ran several policies. The one that they remember and they hate him for most was called Mano Amiga, which was, come out of the gangs, we'll protect you, and you rat out your friends. And so a lot of gang people, they view themselves, the gang leaders, as having to kill a lot of their compañeros because those compañeros are ratting them out. And they that's one thing that they don't view as forgivable with Saca and Funes. You have another anomaly in the Salvadoran elections, which I think is also worrisome a bit to the outside world and to people inside as well, and this is the flow of money from Alba Petróleos into the campaign. Alba Petróleos is a joint venture between PDVSA of Venezuela and a group that was initially formed of FMLN mayors that controlled the mayorships of across El Salvador. It wasn't a government-to-government relationship as it is in Nicaragua, where you have the government of Nicaragua and PDVSA getting petroleum. This petroleum was coming in. You essentially just pay half of it up front at below market prices, and then you have 20 years to pay back the other half at concessionary rates. So essentially, if you're getting 100,000 barrels of oil a day, you can sell 50,000 of that on the open market and clean up, and that's your profit level. There's nothing illegal about it. It's perfectly, you may not like the fact that a lot of Venezuelan money is flowing in, but there's nothing illegal about it. What has become, I think, of great concern is that that money, traditionally, since it started in 2007, 2008, had flowed along at a relatively modest and traceable level and within the parameters of what one would expect of that. And the last couple of years, you've seen the Alba money skyrocket into the hundreds of millions of dollars range with no rational explanation for how that, the origin of that amount of money. So you now see Alba doing Alba Petroleos, Alba Medicamentos. They're trying to buy banks. They're trying to buy hospitals. They're buying enormous amounts of land. They're going into solar energy. They're going into flower growing. They're going into everything that they can get their hands on because they have a lot of cash and they're cash heavy and they're buying stuff. And I think that that has caused a lot of concern in the non-FMLN factions. I think it's safe to say that within the FMLN, all that's left of the FMLN of the five groups that conform the FMLN are the FPL, which is Sánchez Serén and his group, and the Partido Comunista, the Communist Party, which during the war was the least relevant to the five groups. They're a very small armed group. But after the war, some of you have read his name, a gentleman named José Luis Merino, who's now the, I would say, the architect of the financial infrastructure of the FMLN, didn't demobilize entirely his structures and has remained a true force within the FMLN. He's the link to the, he was the enlace with the Frente, with the FARC. He has very close relationships in Venezuela. And he's the one who's handling most of the ALBA projects in El Salvador. And so far, the FMLN has been very unwilling to speak to the origin of this massive amount of money that's coming in. And I think if you look at the division between the FPL and Sánchez Serén and the Communist Party, I think will be quite stark in the coming election. I think that'll be one of the really interesting things if the FMLN wins, because the FPL is not nearly as committed to that ALBA program as the Communist Party is. The FPL has the, I would say, the mass of voters. They have the, but they don't have the money. The Communist Party has the money, and they don't have the mass of voters. It'll be an interesting dynamic to see how that plays out if the Frente were to win. What Arena believes will happen, or at least what they're saying publicly will happen, is that they'll go to a second round, and they'll be able to take most of the bases of the Ghana folks, of the Saka folks, that the Frente has maxed out, that people are getting tired of it. And it, last night, as if you follow Salvadoran press last night, Arena went on TV with a whole bunch of documents purportedly hacked from the Attorney General's office, showing they claim it's consistent with what I think happened, but I don't know if the documents are real or not, showing that the President Funes authorized the gang truce personally, and that the mediators who were supposed to be doing all of this as an act of generosity were actually getting quite a bit of money and cars and things from the government as an attempt to show the government as being tied to a truce that they have at times embraced and at times disowned. And I think one of the more interesting things about the truce is that 2 years after it came into effect and is now basically in tatters, they have never been able to explain how that truce came into being. If you talk to the people and they've been interviewed many times in public, how did this happen from the president to the minister Munilla Páez, they will give you at least 14 different versions within a 30-minute conversation of how that virgin birth of the truce came into being. I think the reason for that is because some of the things that are coming out now, the rather dark and non-transparent background on the truce is something they couldn't own up to at the time. But I think there's a severe mistake to think that Arena, that Funes is the FMLN. Funes never was, and I think that as one of the mistakes, when we're looking at it just in purely campaign terms, attacking Funes as the Frente has backfired miserably for them because the Frente people know that he's not them, and most people understand that, that he's not them. And if you talk with the FMLN themselves, they are very they feel very distant. They don't feel like they've had anything to do with this government. If you talk to them about relations with the United States, they don't understand why people up here view Funes as insulting the ambassador is something that the FMLN did. And I said, well, it's because he ran as an FMLN candidate, and you know, you have to really parse it down to figure out that he's not. But if you run as a candidate and you win as a party, as the candidate of that party, people generally associate you with that party. So you may not like it, but you're kind of stuck with him, and that impression. They were like, oh my God, really? People think that was the FMLN? I'm like, well, only because he says he's FMLN is kind of a problem if you run an election and win as a party. But in a real sense, on the ground, he's right. He was never FMLN. So I think that I still think we're going to a second round. This is the first time I've heard anyone talk about a minimal possibility of the Frente winning in the first round, and it could happen. I think a lot will depend in the last week or 10 days going into this whether Arena can pull itself together a little better and mobilize its own people. I think more than people going to the FMLN, I think you see a lot of people just dropping out about Arena and gone just completely disillusioned with the process. They just don't see any future in it. They're not going to participate. They're not going to give money, certainly, and they may or may not vote. So I think that is going to be the big challenge going forward. And like I said, I think that this particular, and again, it brings me no joy to say it, I think you have relatively, there's no candidate, I think, going forward that would do a huge amount to either assuage the concerns of the United States, deal with corruption internally, or bring anything resembling a rule of law and transparency to the country. So I'll leave it there, and we can take questions. I should clarify, this is not a CSIS position. This is my personal position. I hope more folks are optimistic than I am, but every time I go down there, I become less optimistic until I see, you know, what we have today. Do you wanna? I'm gonna sit down now.
No, that was great, Doug, and super comprehensive, and you've almost left me with no questions. So you've done your job. Let me just ask you two questions, and then I'm going to open it up to folks in the audience. You described a pretty horrific scene, or the horrific visuals with torture and mass graves with the Maras, and I'm trying to understand what are the two options that we have here in case, you know, if Norman Quijano were to win, what would his policy be to deal with the Maras, and what would the policy of Sánchez-Cidén's possible government be to deal with this issue? I'm going to ask all my questions up front, and then I'm going to let you answer. And then, as you know, these elections are pretty tight. And when there are tight elections, unfortunately, it opens up the possibilities to things like fraud and funny business occurring. What's the likelihood of that happening in this election? And the last question that I have is basically, what does the United States stand to gain from either one of these candidates winning? In what scenario are U.S. interests on the narco side, on immigration, on some of the other issues that you mentioned, best served?
Okay, well, thank you, Carl. I think on the gang policy, you know, Quijano's basically, on the Arena side, is basically talking about going back to a more repressive policy. And I think one has to acknowledge two things in the gang-related issue. Nothing prior to the truce worked. I think that you have to acknowledge that trying a new policy was not a cockamamie and stupid idea. It was the result of years of frustration with mano dura, mano super dura, mano amiga, all of that nonsense all of those policies that failed abysmally. So I don't think that, I want to clarify going into this, I don't think that a truce per se is necessarily a bad thing or beyond the purview of the government to carry out. Quijano's basic line is that he wants to go back to the Mano Dura and retake control of the prisons from the Maras, which is, I think, one of the fundamental shifts that you've seen with the truce, is that the Maras always controlled sectors of their prison, without a doubt. Now they control the prisons themselves. They control what prostitutes come in. They control what dopes get distributed. They control who gets to communicate on their cell phones. They control everything. The guards essentially stand outside to watch people coming and going. There's no other control in the prisons where they are most active. So one of the things they really want to do is regain control of the prisons. Very difficult because the gangs have a lot of money and a lot of violence and a lot of ways to get at your families outside the prisons if you're a guard or a prison superintendent. The FMLN has not been overly vocal on what they would do. They view the truce as, what they tell me, is failed. They don't want to return to the Mano Dura, and they don't really have any other clear ideas. I think that there is a feeling that a transparent truce in which the civilian population were included. I think one of the great criticisms of the truce, besides just the logistics and how it was born in Salvadoran society, is that it makes no mention of the victims of the gangs or restitution or anything to do with the victims. The victims are excluded entirely from the process. There's a feeling that you could do a real truce in which you had transparency, which groups committed themselves to it, in which the government would then put in certain resources to help other certain things happen as far as getting the gangs into employment, stuff like that. The pushback now is, okay, if they're going to do that with them, how many people do I have to kill before you give me employment? You know, how many people do I have to extort before you decide that I'm worthy of being incorporated? Because the job creation factor there is near zero. So I think basically the answer is there is no good alternative out there on that, and no one is thinking creative. Very few people are thinking creatively. Tight elections, I did not hear concern in anyone I talked to across the political spectrum about fraud. Salvador, I think, has done very well since the peace agreements have gone into effect. I don't think the FMLN has ever felt it was cheated out of elections, and I don't think, although the FMLN now controls most of the electoral apparatus, there does not seem to be a great deal of fear on the Arena side that fraud will be out there. Doesn't mean it can't happen, it's just not in the air. People aren't saying, oh my God, they're going to do this. What does the U.S. stand to gain from either side? I think that's a really difficult question. I think, you know, in a different world, we would have had, the United States administration was very favorably disposed to Funes, and watching a historic change from Arena to an elected government of the left who had been in an armed conflict and had then come into the process, I think it was viewed as a very powerful symbol of what can happen as conflicts wind down, and if you play by the rules, you can eventually win and be rewarded. So I think that one of the things that the Funes administration has done in squandering that is made it very difficult to see what options the U.S. would have. I think they're, you know, Arena have used themselves as the natural allies of the United States, their free market and all of these things. The FMLN is essentially saying, look, we kept talking about transparency in my conversation with them, and they was like, if we bring transparency and are serious about bringing, you know, some sort of justice and redistribution and stuff, how will the United States react? I said, I think, you know, I don't know. But I think that you could, if you distanced yourself from the worst, I think if any of these groups distance themselves from the worst elements, which are easily identifiable within their structures, the United States could certainly work with them. I think the huge advantage from the U.S. point of view is policy-wise, not my own personal endorsement, is that the FMLN now has a virtually unlimited source of outside money. There's nothing our aid will do that will interest them at all because they have much more money coming from other sources. Arena will still be much more dependent on traditional economic structures and traditional aid structures, and I would think more responsive to different types of things the United States wanted to do, simply because it's within sort of the traditional confines of their financial structure so far.
Let me open it up here up front. Just wait for a microphone.
Great. Yeah, Hilda Ochoa, Strategic Investment Group. What seems to be happening in Latin America is that we have drifted from the threat of communism, populism, but a political philosophy to essentially a criminal codependency with drug lords and corrupt government officials, and it's getting worse. So the when you look at the scene in Latin America, there are very few countries that are turning towards the better right now, Mexico being one of them, Colombia maybe. Some that were turning to high rates of growth and employment, et cetera, like Peru, are now drifting. There is now Sendero Luminoso is reappearing in Peru, and there is drug production and distribution now generating a significant amount of income in Peru. So when you, at some point we thought we were winning kind of the war in Latin America, the Pax Americana, when we had fended off Cuba, communism, and when we were actually winning the war on drugs, quote unquote, in Colombia, it appeared to be a very short truce. I'm not even sure that if the Fidel regime, that if somehow Cuba became a global trade partner, if Cuba then would not be criminalized completely, which it isn't right now. So that criminal activity would replace communism in Cuba. So all of this is to say, is there a silver bullet? And suggest that the only potential policy silver bullet the United States could have to notch the trend would be a significant change in our drug policy. Well, essentially, where legal drug traffic would then replace illegal drug traffic and criminal drug traffic.
Well, I think that it's true. I think in the years of dealing with Latin America, I don't think I've ever seen such a divergence between what U.S. policy on the counter-drug front is and what people on the ground in Central America and, frankly, much further south want to see happen. What the driving imperative for Central America, and it's, I think, entirely rational, is for the violence to go away. The United States has a policy of drug interdiction and in combating drugs frontally. I think it's a very, very dangerous divergence because there's very little common ground between the two. And as long as that remains the case, you'll have a very difficult time bringing people on board for a policy that we still carry out. That being said, I think that you do have a really compelling model with multiple flaws, but I think the macro model in Colombia. And I think what changed the balance, that shifted the correlación de fuerzas in Colombia, was when the Colombians recognized and then assumed responsibility for the war, particularly with the FARC and drug trafficking, as their own because it was ruining their country. The driving imperative for Colombia was not Plan Colombia. If you look at the numbers, and we just have finished a report on Colombia, at no point, at the maximum point of U.S. aid to the military, it was never more than 24% of what the Colombians were spending in the Uribe government, and now it's 4%. They put enormous amounts of resources, taxed their own people, the people paid their taxes, because they viewed that struggle not as something related to the United States, but as something that related to their own survival. I think Central America has a significant disadvantage in this regard because there are seven tiny countries who barely talk to each other and coordinate almost nothing amongst each other. Colombia is a fairly large country with one military, one president, one policy, and one entity that the United States and other groups could channel their aid for. Two, Central America doesn't. And so essentially, if it's not done at least on a regional level of the Northern Triangle, but preferably all seven, you're basically doing nothing. The reason El Salvador and Central America are inundated with cocaine trafficking now is because there was success in cracking down on the Caribbean route. When did all of this stuff start? When that was relatively successful. And you have the push of the Mexicans down south, and it's their home turf to play on. There are multiple reasons, but I think that until there's a joint decision and a joint effort, the United States has fewer and fewer interlocutors with which it can discuss counter-narcotics policy and expect anything other than rampant corruption to come out of that cooperation, because it's just they're really on entirely different pages now. And like I said, the driving imperative, and it's not irrational. I mean, Guatemala is, 70 homicides per 100,000. focalized, it's not all over the country, but it's a disaster. When you have gangs doing what they're doing in El Salvador and Honduras, especially San Pedro Sula, the most violent city in the world, it's not irrational for the citizens to say, whoa, make this go away. And that's going to be the driving imperative in internal policy.
That's great. Do you have a question?
Thank you. My name is Jose Cardenas with the consulting firm Vision Americas here in Washington. Carl, thanks for sponsoring, hosting this session today, and Doug, for your always very useful insights. I wanted to stay on this topic of counter-narcotics. And when you look, as you well know, when you look at the other ALBA countries in the region, the radical populists, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, and the rise to power of those governments has had an extremely deleterious effect on our counter-narcotics cooperation. You mentioned Sanchez Cerén, the alliances, the close associations he has with the likes of somebody like José Luis Merino, the FARC's man in El Salvador. And the Spanish newspaper ABC also had a recent article talking about Merino, that basically he continues his associations. Could you speculate what a Sanchez Cerén government in El Salvador, what impact do you suspect it will have on our security and counter-narcotics cooperation?
Well, I think what Sanchez Cerén has made clear publicly is that they will embrace the ALBA and join the bloc, I think, enthusiastically. It's not a problem when you view the money, you see the money coming in through PDVSA into ALBA Petroleos in El Salvador, and the massive amounts of money that's going through there. It's a rational decision for them to make, because that's what they're going to live off of. I think the long-term consequences of having massive non-transparent infusions of cash into one political party, or if they become the government, into the government, is one of the things that has been the most damaging to the democratic processes in the Bolivarian countries. I think when Chavez took PDVSA as his own funding mechanism and it stopped going through budget approval processes, and he suddenly had this giant slush fund of several billion dollars, that is what drove, I think, that gave him the resources to drive the anti-democratic impulses that and the things that grew out of that. I think the same has happened in Ecuador and in Bolivia. So I would say that to me, the impact on democracy, I think, will be dramatic if within the FMLN they choose to continue down that road. On counter-narcotics, I think that it's not going to be a priority for the Sanchez Cerén government. I think that there will be a significant struggle over the Merino wing and the other parts of the FMLN. I think it's clear that Merino has maintained contacts with the FARC and other groups, and it's clear that he manages the enterprise, the ALBA enterprise there. On counter-narcotics, I mean, I don't think there'll be much interest in doing much, because it's not something that they view as their problem. But I would add that I don't think any of the other countries either, any other parties either, will be particularly active, simply because it's not part of their political, you know, there's nothing driving them politically to embrace counter-narcotics. Everything is driving them internally politically to get rid of the violence. And I think if you want to look at how violence diminishes, you can look at the Nicaraguan model, where there's a fair amount of traffic through there. It's controlled in certain ways by the government. They don't drop product in the country. They move it on through, and there are certain power structures that make sure that goes through. And so you have no violence, everyone makes a little money, and voila, it's great. And I think my opinion is that we're going to see a significant movement toward the Nicaraguan model in Central America. And I think that will essentially create free corridors across the isthmus of cocaine flowing through, where if they're smart, if they do like the Nicaraguans, parts of the Nicaraguans have done, they won't allow the Mexicans to establish themselves there, and then they drive them out. They won't allow gangs to establish, too late for the gangs, but they didn't allow the gangs to establish themselves there, and they don't allow product to be dropped there. So you have the elimination of the violent factors. Money is made, and off the stuff goes, and it's not viewed at that point, especially if they're not letting them drop product, is their own internal problem. And I think that that is a model that that we will, I think, is something that Otto Perez has talked about in Guatemala, not openly, but it's the part of what he's been saying with the legalization, et cetera. And I think that at the heart of it, that's what a large part of the gang truce was. They were creating a free flow corridor across the Metapan, Chalatenango Metapan region into Guatemala. The idea was to get rid of the violence, get the gangs cooperating, buy them off, and stability, which is what every good businessman wants.
Up here up front.
Thanks. Stacey Brown with IRI, thank you for your presentation. Given the high levels of fatigue and cynicism among the population that you mentioned earlier, I have two questions. What is the likelihood of there being high voter abstentions in the election? And secondly, will this have an impact on immigration flows? People become fatigued and they just decide to leave. Thank you.
On the voter abstention, the honest answer is I don't know. I would say that of all the elections I followed down there from before and then after the peace process, I would be surprised if this didn't have the highest abstention rates by far of all of them. But I have no data to go on. That's just a gut feeling, so I don't know. On the immigration flows, I think that there are multiple factors that play into that. I think that if people could just up and leave, they would. I think that there is a sense that their own countries are relatively hopeless and they want something better. The counterweight to that in practical terms is, one, the U.S. job market isn't very good, and two, the CETAs and other groups and Mexicans have made that crossing both much more expensive and much more dangerous. So if you talk to the coyotes who are moving people, they were moving in a few years ago every week 30, 40, 50 people in their groups. Now they're moving maybe 20, 30 people a month because of the different factors. One of the primary factors is that the CETAs at the time, I don't think it's happening as much now as the CETAs have been sort of pushed back, but the different Mexican groups were taxing and killing the migrants coming across, and they've discovered that if you can take 20 Chinese who will pay $60,000 for the trip, or a whole bunch of Salvadoran, and what the coyotes will tell you is that when something happens to the Chinese, they'll call home and get more money. If the CETAs stop them and ask for another $1,000, they have it. If you're a Salvadoran going through and you've spent your last money to get there, they can't squeeze you. There's nothing left to give. And so so they kill you or make your life hell. And so for various factors, the movement hasn't started or won't, it may not because of practical factors, but not because of psychological factor. I think people would like to go if they could.
In the back.
My name is Sarah Wines, and I'm the USAID representative to the U.S. Southern Command and based in Miami, Florida. And I was reading your bio where you apparently have addressed many military audiences. And my question is, what in your view should be the top priorities of our U.S. military's key leader engagements in the region? And I'm going at finding the leadership within the region of Brazil, Colombia, who are now more and more concerned about the implosion occurring in Venezuela and looking towards exporting their security expertise to other countries. And how do you see that having an impact on Central America? Thanks.
Well, I think the Colombians are playing, an increasing role in providing the security training. The question I think now is, and I think this has changed particularly in El Salvador in the last, whenever Munoz Páez came in as Minister of Public Security, you had maintained in El Salvador a pretty good police corps at the core leadership at the top. With the entrance of General Munoz Páez, you saw the decay, and most of them were FMLN. That had survived and lived there. And they were doing, I think, a remarkably good job as police. Munoz Páez came in and decapitated that structure and brought back in the absolute worst elements that had been expelled from the police for everything from homicides to massive corruption. And that, I think, is sort of the end of the Salvadoran police as we know it for the time being. So I'm not sure what the Salvadoran, what the Colombians could train them, who they would be training. I think it's our dilemma back in the 80s when you're training a lot of really bloodthirsty military officers in school in the Americas, and then they go back and they're better death squad folks than they would have been if we hadn't trained them. And I think you're running into that process across the board in Central America right now, where there aren't a lot of good interlocutors. There are some, and you have to really look for them. U.S. military engagement, I think, in the region, I think one of the striking things about the Bolivarian, Venezuelan influence in the region and in the Bolivarian countries is they're making a very systematic and concerted effort to eradicate any vestiges of U.S. military doctrine in the region. It's a very high priority for them. They have a whole new bunch of books developed, a whole bunch to go to both, there are a whole bunch of really interesting things that not many people are paying attention to, but it's an entirely new doctrine they're trying to pull out on social engagement, on asymmetrical warfare, all kinds of stuff. So I think that that's a disturbing element of the Bolivarian Revolution, because I think that as flawed as U.S. policy, military policy has been in the region, particularly since the end of the Cold War, the human rights emphasis and things have been very robust, very good, and I think helped the military in many ways. And that's going to disappear. So I guess my answer is that unless you know specifically and well who your interlocutors are that you're going to be dealing with, you don't want to be engaged in training exercises and money exercises. I think one of the things that I've pushed for, I've done a fair amount of stuff with Southcom, and there are legal reasons why it's difficult to do. If you look at the Colombian experience, which I also lived up quite close and personal, one of the defining changes in there was when they were able to get small vetted units sharing. If you ask, I'm sure you know, if you ask people in El Salvador, the good cops I know in El Salvador, if something's happening, your guys run into Honduras, who do you call? No idea, man. I don't have any idea who I would trust over there. And say if you ask the Guatemalans, God knows, we have no idea. I think that the idea of a regional vetted unit that could talk across international, it's complicated legally to do that, and I know that. But I think some way of having small trusted groups of people that can actually exchange information where something would then be done with that information is sort of the first step to being able to, and it has to be regional because it doesn't do any good for the Salvadorans to know because the guy will be in Honduras within 30 minutes and then you've lost that. But other than that, I would say that it's very difficult because one of the points of my PRISM article was that there are fewer and fewer interlocutors with whom we share a common interest and with whom can be relatively sure that money won't be used for things other than what we intended.
So essentially you're saying the military in Latin America, as an institution that was working potentially decently well relative to drug traffickers, has been decimated by the ALBA influence around the region.
I don't think that's across the board. I think that is the focus of the ALBA countries, which I think if you're looking at what the FMLN would do if they won, I think that would be part of the impact. I think there are good military and police people in every country, and I know some of them, certainly not all of them. But I think that they are an endangered minority. I don't want to blanketly say that you can't deal with people, but I think that structures have grown up. If you look in Honduras particularly, every unit of the police responds to a different drug trafficking organization. And then you name on top of that a police chief who had serious human rights issues from back in the 80s. Like, okay, what are you doing here? I mean, what are we doing here? And so I think that in some ways, taking a deep breath and saying maybe more money and more stuff right now is not the answer, maybe a better way of looking at it. The traditional thing is if we just do a little bit more, what we're doing. And by every indices in the region, I think, homicide rates, incarceration rates, prison overpopulation, poverty, everything's worse and we put a lot of money into it in the last, or through CARSI and other things in the last few years. So I think it's time to take a breath and say, okay, let's figure out what did work, but let's not just do a little bit more of the same, because it doesn't seem to be leading us to any place that's healthy.
Roger. Thank you very much. Roger Noriega with the American Enterprise Institute, and also with consulting firm Vision Americas. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Doug, I was going to ask you if your friend wanted to hang himself after he talked to you, or before.
Before that was the opening. Yeah, I hadn't even said anything.
And he's a goner after this, because it's a very sobering presentation. But I appreciate it very much. No one who knows you doubts the integrity of what you laid out here. One of the questions I would ask, you seem to suggest that there's some sort of wall between FMLN as political party and potential public policymakers, and FMLN as criminal enterprise. And when you see Jose Luis Merino with such an extraordinarily powerful role in the country, let alone the political movement, and his association with the FARC and all of the criminal enterprises in the Americas, I don't see how we could expect Sanchez Cerén to do anything other than go along with the criminality that's already rampant in the country. And then second question is, you know, the United States, we shouldn't just be seeing if we can, quote, work with whomever wins in a democratic election in El Salvador. You know, when you see, why haven't we done things like used treasury sanctions vis-a-vis Jose Luis Merino and some of these other prominent criminals who have such an impact in that country today? What is U.S. law enforcement doing to, in an asymmetrical way, go after these threats?
Well, I think there are still a lot of good people in the FMLN who one may not agree with politically, but I think are sort of decent and honest people. I think that, and I think you've had some good ministers in this cabinet that have come out of the FMLN. And I think that, as I said, the police structure under the FMLN was quite robust with FMLN folks there. I think the Merino wing is predominant. And I think that they control the money. And I think that ultimately that can be the final catastrophe for the FMLN. I'm not sure it is that way yet. And I know that there are a lot of people in the FMLN who are aware of these problems, who would like to be more transparent. What the correlation of forces is and how that will shake out internally, I don't know. But I think that they're at a very decisive time. And I think it's been a long war. The reality is Merino has won most of the battles at this point. So whether that will change or not, I don't know. I think what you have to understand, what the history of Merino's movement is quite interesting, because he was the one after the 1992 peace accords who didn't demobilize the urban commandos. And he went immediately into kidnappings. And he kidnapped the son of, there are several famous kidnappings, including the son of Saul Suster. So I think that he has a long history of criminal activity. He kidnapped in Brazil. He taught the FARC how to do urban kidnapping. He did a series of things. So I don't have any illusions about how he emerged or what he represents. I do know there are a lot of people in the FMLN who are opposed to that and would like to do something different. I don't know how that correlation of fuerzas will turn out. On what folks are doing on this end, on the criminal side or the sanctioning side, et cetera, I think what you see is an enormous lack of knowledge and an enormous lack of interest. I think that, why hasn't Treasury OFAC sanctioned people? Because they have very, very few people who are looking at anything related to Central America at all. It's not stupidity. It's not a priority. And when in a time of limited resources and a time of multiple other engagements that are viewed as much higher priority, Central America and perhaps most of Latin America has just not on the radar to have the resources allocated to follow this stuff in a significant way. I think it's gotten to the point in across the hemisphere where we really need to recalibrate the interest level. But nothing's exploded yet. Nobody, you know, we haven't had a huge incident yet. And so the attention isn't being paid. I hope it doesn't get to the point where that has to happen before people say, oh my God, what happened down there? But I think the potential of alliances, and I mean, one of the other things that I think Merino has been instrumental in is helping Iran and others recruit people to go for training and things like that. So I think there's a constellation of little red lights that should be going off, but it's not one big siren yet.
One last question here.
Hi, my name is Kathleen Tolentino. I'm here on behalf of COHA. This 2014 presidential election will be the first time absentee voting is allowed.
Yeah,
I wanted to know if you thought the one-fifth Salvadorians living in the United States would have an influential impact on these elections.
I would guess yes. I don't know what the registration numbers and things are for the Hermanos Lejanos is. But I would say that I think that that population in the United States is much less negative toward the range of political options in El Salvador than the people on the ground there are. Because here you're looking at it from a distance, I think there's still a sort of romantic attachment to other things. So I think, yes, they'll probably will, because a lot of them will vote. And they care deeply, and they send a lot of money back, et cetera. But what the actual numbers are, I don't know. But I think I had forgotten that that was true, that this was going to be the first time. And I think it'll be a really interesting experiment. And I think it has certainly the potential to have some weight internally, absolutely.
Well, great. I want to thank you, Doug, for taking the time to do this. This has been a sobering and very in-depth presentation. I also wanted to announce that this is the first of probably two sessions that we're going to have with Doug having to do with the elections. There is a second round, or it's likely that there will be a second round, and I think we'll benefit from your knowledge and your expertise after having gone down there. And if there is that second round, which is very likely, we'll be having a second session that will probably, you know, provide the information that we gather from the first round and be able to interpret it and explain it. And you know, obviously we encourage you and welcome all of you to come to that session as well. But thank you very much, Doug.
Thank you, Carl.
Thanks.
Thank you for